This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
The Quran Institute will be holding a new upcoming course on race and gender for this July,
inshallah,
which will help students understand the various controversies in the West, from the culture war between the left wing and the right wing, identity politics, critical race theory, to the various intersectional and non-intersectional feminisms, abortion rights debates, and transgender debates. It will critically explain the various left-wing ideologies in the West, their schools of thought, history, and their arguments and philosophies, and how to deconstruct and refute them, and effectively engage them and respond to them from the Islamic worldview. The online course begins end of July 2022, open to all students globally for online attendance. There's also an on-site attendance option for students based in London, UK. See link in the description.
If you'd like to see more content like this, please support the channel by subscribing and clicking the notification bell. If you find this video insightful and beneficial, please support the YouTube algorithm to spread it by liking, commenting, and sharing. Thank you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Firstly, Ramadan, welcome to everyone. Thank you for everybody. Thank you to everyone for coming. I know that you guys are busy as well, but it's going to be a great event. Start Abdullah says, kindly come over all the way from London. And he's going to talk about something that he's, he talks about a lot, and you can find him all over, the internet, and he's had a lot of debates. He's very intellectual, very engaging, very informed about these sort of topics that are very important to us, especially living in the West. So without further ado, I'm going to pass it over to the start.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen, as-salamu alayhi wa sallam, Nabi Kareem Muhammad, al-Ali Tayyibin wa sahbihi salihin, as-salamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Hope everyone's doing okay. I'd like to thank the various Liverpool ISOCs. You've got a kind of federation of ISOCs here. And also Abdullah Quirim Society, what I've been led to believe is the first functional mosque or masjid in the UK. So it's quite an honor to be here. As well as Abdullah Quilliam is someone that's quite well known. And Abdullah Quilliam argued that Muslims had owed allegiance to the Ottoman Caliph, and that he was worried there'd be a war coming up. This is before World War I. And he went over to, it was believed he went over to fight for the Ottoman Caliphate to defend it against the invaders. So Abdullah Quilliam had some very wonderful things to say about Muslim unity, about revival, about uniting the Muslim Ummah, defending it against invaders, especially the British army and so on and so forth. So it's quite an honor and a privilege to be in the masjid that he founded. So anyway, but let's go back to more fundamental questions about reality rather than about a persona. So today's going to be a discussion on atheism, but also the Quran's undeniable arguments for God. Many people think that if you have to argue for God's existence, you have to use stuff outside of the Quran, like, I don't know, philosophy, read some Greek thinking, read some Christian thinking, appropriate their arguments, and then basically argue it and make to be convincing in front of atheists and to convince Muslims that God exists. But really, all the arguments are already contained in the Quran. That many Muslims just don't realize that they really are in the Quran. And these arguments are very effective and are very rational. And by rational, I simply mean that they make sense, there's no contradictions in them, and they inevitably and exclusively point to only one answer behind reality, which is that there must be a creator that has will, that decided and determined all things and created all things. So, the first question we should ask ourselves is, does knowing God exists require complicated arguments? No, it really doesn't. So then why do you hear all these complicated arguments being used in the public realm? What's going on? Why do you hear all this philosophy using more technical philosophical jargon, like you might hear the term necessity or contingency or dependency independent existence, all these different terms? Why do you see all that when surely then, if God is so evident in his existence, why do you need such complicated arguments that most people don't know about or don't use these terms, these technical terms? And they sound very obscure and very abstract. Well, the answer to that is that you can know God's existence very simply. All human beings, generally speaking, throughout human history, most human civilizations believed in divinity, something divine. It's almost unanimous in in every culture. However, there's differences which came on later on, but certainly every culture believed in one ultimate creator God, or a first creator. And it's a very simple argument. Here's the simplest argument that anyone can understand, and most people, most human civilizations, just realized, which is, if you just take something which is observable, the human fitrah, you could say, our natural propensity for things such as just a kid asks, where do babies come from? The kid knows that babies don't come out of nothing, and they're not made by nothing. These are basic rational things that everyone has. Rational just means, the word in ratio in Latin just means thinking. But it's the basic thinking process that all humans who have intellect come to, right? So they say humans see all things all things that they see are incidental and they came from somewhere else. Incidental means that they come about by an event that happened. So, you know, the trees grow out from the ground. That's an event that happened. The tree wasn't always there. They see that, they don't see the hills forming, but they can see that everything around them, the wind, birds, everything around them comes about by something. Everything that's incidental, let's say, it brought about by happenstance, comes from somewhere else. Something else caused it. So humans realize that. It's basic, simple observation. All things which are a result of happenstance come from something else. Then humans see that they didn't make reality. When you were born, one of the first things you noticed is that there's something outside yourself that's not you, and you can't control it. So you didn't make it, and you can't control it. But it's controlling you in some ways, you're this outside external world to yourself. Babies realize this from a young age. Humans know that they have a mind, and they know that mind can make deliberate things. So there's incidental things, things are just made by, let's just use the word random, of things that happen in the world. And then there are things that are made by, which are deliberate. Yeah, so carvings, cars, your mobile phone, clocks, what have you, this table and chairs. These are deliberate things that were made deliberately. And you have a mind, and you know that you can make things deliberately. And so you understand, all humans understand that, okay, well, deliberate things are made deliberately by something that has a mind. You have a mind, and so you know that you can do those things. So then ultimately, all humans just realize that all incidental things must come from something deliberate. So basically, you can't have, if everything in the world is incidental, it came from something else, that came from something else, it came from something else, but you can't just have it going back forever. They knew that it was a beginning point where the first thing was not incidental that was created, and if it was created, it's not incidental, then it was created by something that did it deliberately, and then it must have a mind. Not like your mind, all humans realize that there must be a mind behind everything. Basic fitrah realization that all humans come to. So then, they realize that there must be a mind behind the whole universe, behind everything that they see, and so they'll call it the creator. If the creator is able to build the earth, sun, moon, and stars, he must have very vast power, a lot of power. Well, that's quite obvious, again, but a basic, simple realization. So the whole universe works, and then there's bonus realizations that you can make. So you can say the whole universe works quite regularly, there can only be one controller over everything. Yeah, so the universe, everything works quite regularly, quite ordered, there's not multiple people fighting over, multiple creators fighting over this one universe. It seems to be all under the control of one creator, and even in the most polytheistic of religions, they always believed in a head god. There was always a head god. And of course, the creator can't resemble incidental things. Because if the creator is an incidental thing himself, made up by happenstance, then what made that? So the ultimate creator can't be incidental, can't look like an incidental thing, can't look like a tree, can't look like a rock, can't look like the sun or the moon or what have you. Now, I use the word incidental, it just means like things that just occur due to events. That's all it means, simple. And deliberate things, well, you know what deliberate means. So this is the real basic argument, if you'd like, that all human beings generally, using their intuition, your subconscious processor power, your intellectual processing power, comes to that general realization in most civilizations. You know, you call it the fitrah, because it's not something that you develop later on, but even babies, when they did an experiment, they showed babies an image on the screen, something moving, and then it disappears, and then the ball reappears elsewhere. A ball was moving. The baby looks at it like very shocked because the babies expect causality, cause and effect, not things just pop out of existence from nothing. It shocks the baby. So you're built with this fitrah expectation that things that happen due to events have a causality to them. right? Basic fitrah. This is in your fitrah. And that's it. This is all it, this is as complicated as it requires to be, that is required to be to know that God exists. Now, the Quran gives an argument for to those who are a bit obstinate. Yeah, those who reject the basic observations that humans naturally make when they're born and when they look at the world, there's a reality that's greater than themselves. They don't control it. It must be controlled by something else that has a greater mind, of course. So the Quran says, or were they created by nothing, or were they themselves the creators? So you can't be created by nothing, of course, that makes sense. You didn't create yourself, you didn't create the heavens and the earth, and so if you didn't create the heavens and the earth, then you must be created by something else, another mind, not your mind, but something else. Basic, simple, fitri observation, the Quran is trying to get through to that, to trigger that basic intuition that you have. And of course, it continues, it asks that they don't possess the power behind the universe, they don't control everything in the universe, and they are not omniscient either, right? So they're not. So they don't know everything about the universe, they don't control it, so what other alternative is there except there is something higher than them that controls everything, and they don't control everything. So the humans aren't gods, but there is a God that created human beings. So you know that you haven't always existed, of course, and you didn't create yourself, and you have a mind, and so if the universe, if whatever is behind the universe can create something with a mind, it too must have a mind as well. Let's say a basic intuition that you can come to. However, there's one little problem. Why don't all human beings believe in God, or one God to be exact? And the reason for that is humans introduce assumptions. They introduce assumptions. And these assumptions are, the problem of an assumption is, when you assume something about something, it messes up your thinking process, the conclusion you're going to get to, if you assume something is incorrect. So if you just invent an assumption and it's wrong, you're going to get a problem. Every time you don't understand something, or every time you make a mistake in your entire life, every mistake you will ever make is because you made an assumption about something. Every single mistake that you ever make is because you made an assumption. And of course, the problem is humans like to make loads of assumptions. And what's worse is they teach the kids those assumptions. And the kids, they need to learn from the parents, right? It's part of your fitrah to learn from the parents because you need to survive, right? So the parents tell you, don't jump off a cliff. You need to learn that, okay, jumping off a cliff is gonna be bad for my health. Or sticking my head in the oven is going to be bad for my health, yeah. Or playing with sharp objects is going to be painful and bad for my health potentially. So the child already uncritically borrows and learns everything they can from the parents, and that is the avenue by which and the assumptions are taken to the next generation, because the kids are taught assumptions that the parents hold, which are just wrong, basically. Want to close the door, or is it a bit too loud? Yeah. Okay. They don't know that this door is the. The room, would they? Oh, they call Sod's laws, they say. The moment I close it, that's when someone has to come in. Okay, this. You see what I'm talking about? Okay, all right. Well, they can open it, But it, no one came in to close the door. All right, there we go. Now, if I said, you know what, they were waiting out there until I was about to close the door, and then they came in, that would be an assumption. Of course, it's just coincidence, right? But you make an assumption, you come out with the wrong conclusion. I saw this documentary called Inside the Medieval Mind. It was about the European medieval mind. And the European medieval mind, they had so many weird things they believed in. They believed that there were people around the world, or all parts of the world, that had human bodies, but the heads of dogs. And then they had debates amongst Christian theologians, had debates as to whether they had souls and you could save them by preaching Christianity to them, and whether they should be open to the teachings of Jesus. All this debate they had over something that they had no evidence for, they just made up. And then someone took it, ran with it, and they just assumed, oh, that was the case. You see, and the documentarian that was talking about the medieval mind, or the European medieval mind, they said that the Europeans, even though they had debates on weird things and they believed weird stuff, they said that they weren't any less rational than people are today. Their starting assumptions was the problem. Okay? Their starting assumptions was the problem. And, I mean, if you think, well, are Muslims impervious to assumptions? No, they're very much, unfortunately, just as susceptible to assumptions and that many people follow. There was this case where a European visited an Ottoman soldier, Ottoman lands, and spoke to a soldier who was, this is about 1500s. So the Ottoman, it was probably a Janissary or what have you, and he was talking about, he goes into battle and he doesn't wear armor like the Europeans. And so the European was like, why don't you wear armor? And he said, oh, because my life and death is qadar. So it's by divine decree. So if it's by divine decree, then there's no point in me wearing armor because I'll only die when I'm meant to die. Okay? Well, true, that's what we believe as Muslims. But there's the assumption is that whether you wear armor or not, from your own perspective, for us human beings, it would make no difference. If he had wore armor, maybe Allah would have willed that he died later on, not in battle, because he was wearing armor and that protected him from most of the hits he might receive, and that he'd die much later in life. Caliph Omar encountered a Muslim who had the assumption of qadar, the wrong assumptions about what qadar means. And there was a plague in Syria. He went to visit Syria and he heard of a plague, and then he decided to stay away from that place until the plague had passed. And then someone said to Omar, are you running away from Allah's qadar? And he said, if I go to Syria, that's Allah's qadar. And if I stay out of Syria, that's Allah's qadar too. You understand? So if you have an assumption, you're going to come to the wrong conclusion. So you say, oh, well, you know what? No point wearing masks or expose yourself to COVID. In fact, why don't you lick the rails or go on the train and lick the bars? Because it doesn't matter. It's qadar. If you get sick, it's qadar, right? Well, you say, well, that's a bit stupid because... it could have been Allah's qadar that you were stupid and that you licked the rails and you got sick because of that stupidity. So you've made it, you haven't made it qadar, but in essence, you've discovered that the qadar was that. Yeah? All we know about the case of the angel of death was seeing someone, and this was at a time where people, some people could see the angel of death at a point or near their death, and they saw the angel of death and they got scared and they ran a long distance. And an angel of death seemed to be shocked to see him at a different place, and he ran that to another place, thinking he'll escape the angel of death. And then when he ran a long distance, he discovered the angel of death waiting for him at that spot. And angel of death said to him, "I was surprised to see you elsewhere because I knew that I was going to meet you here today." Right. So again, if you have an assumption, you're going to get the wrong conclusion. It's your assumptions that will distort your thinking. Right. So humans have made assumptions, and that leads to problems. That leads to them now coming up to the wrong conclusions. So this basic intuitive understanding of God's existence becomes distorted, where people say, hey, maybe there's more than one God, like there's more than one king on earth. Yeah? So they've made an assumption now. What does the multiple kings on earth got to do with the creator behind the universe? Yeah, they're not comparable. So then you're assuming there's a comparison, and that leads you to think, oh, then polytheism is possible, whereas before it was impossible. But you think it's possible because of an assumption. Or, hey, I hate feeling guilty for wanting things I'm prohibited by God from. How do I know he even exists? I've never seen him, and I don't get punished whenever I break his laws. Assumptions. Just because you don't see something doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Almost all new knowledge that you'll ever learn in this world, you never saw before. Or there'll be things that you learn all the time. So just because you don't see it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Of course, again, they also assumed, well, if God exists and he wants me to follow these laws, why don't I get punished the instant I break them? That's an assumption. You assume that God enforces those laws like a king enforces the laws in society. The king has to enforce laws in society to create order in that society. Right? If there's no order in that society, then obviously, because people break the laws, then there's going to be problems. So the king has to do it immediately. The king or the police or whatever have to enforce the laws immediately, as soon as they know about it. Right? But God's laws is not for maintaining, the purpose of your existence is not so that you can help God maintain an orderly universe. That's not, God doesn't need your help. But to be tested whether you will follow the good and bad ordained by the Creator. So the assumption is that God operates like a police force. He needs your help to maintain order on earth. That's not, maintain human order. That's not the reason. But the assumption then leads you to the wrong conclusion. You think, well, he must not exist then because I don't get struck by lightning as soon as I break a law. Or maybe there was no beginning, just endless eternity in the past. Even though, again, the obvious reason for that is infinite regress, a fallacy, as you know. If we had to wait an infinite amount of time to get for this lecture to begin, it would never begin. Or if this lecture begins and I tell you, don't worry, this lecture will only go on for an infinite amount of time, then it stops, it will never end. Because infinity doesn't exhaust, doesn't complete. So we know that doesn't make sense. But if someone doesn't, is not aware of it, and they simply say, well, you know how we can go back in time, we can imagine going back in time like 20 years. What about 100 years? What about 1,000 years? Hey, what about forever? You've just made an assumption that just because you can remember there's a past, there must be an infinite past. That's where the assumption comes about. And it leads to contradiction and problems, incorrect conclusion. So then, before we discuss the assumptions that lead to this, what is atheism? Atheism is simply a belief or worldview that lacks God. Simply, that's all it is. Just anyone that has a worldview belief where there's no God in it. So that's simply what it is. But the reasons for that vary between atheists. So there's an atheist that simply suspends belief in God, doesn't choose to believe in God, but doesn't reject his possibility. Just says, I don't see enough evidence to make me choose to believe in God in any way, shape, or form, even though you might believe he's a possibility, right? And they might give a different reason. They might say, I don't think that he's likely to exist, so he might exist, but he's not likely to exist, therefore I choose that I won't, even though he might unlikely exist, I still choose not to believe that he exists, for example. That's what it means. So that's why they choose to suspend belief in God. The second type of atheist is the rejecter. So they will simply say that they reject the belief in God. They think that he doesn't exist. He cannot exist. Because either they think that the belief in God is an inconsistent concept. They think it has contradictions in it, which it doesn't. But their assumptions about God has contradictions, yes. Or they believe that what they see in observable reality doesn't match what they assume would be the case if God exists. Right? So the reason for being an atheist depends on the assumptions the atheist holds. Right? The reason why people are atheists is because they have assumptions. That's why they're atheist. So what does that mean now? Why are more sophisticated arguments used today? Why do we need more sophisticated, not why do we need, but why do we use more sophisticated arguments to prove God's existence today? Why? Because the assumptions are more sophisticated. The atheists bring more and more assumptions that are more sophisticated. By sophisticated, I simply mean so long and contrived that they can hide the contradiction inside it. You don't see the contradiction easily. That's what we mean by sophisticated. Because you can't simply say, hey, let's believe that something does come from nothing. You say, and by nothing. You say, that's ridiculous. It's not gonna say like that. They're gonna say it as, before the universe, there's a non-zero probability of a quantum nucleation event occurring in vacuum, and therefore, if a quantum nucleation event occurs, reaches a certain threshold, we can show that it would then lead to the processes that would create the universe, that would see the universe as we see the expansion and so on and so forth. I've basically said something comes from nothing by nothing, but you don't hear the contradiction in it because it's so abstract and so convoluted. Yeah. So, and actually, this is a theory by Alexander Vilenkin. He's a physicist, and he says there's a non-zero probability of there being a quantum fluctuation, and then if the quantum fluctuation reaches a certain threshold, we can then map out how the universe is the mechanism by which it forms into expansion. So, what he said, just to break it down, I'm going to give you an analogy. If I was to go to any kitchen in Liverpool, there's a non-zero chance that I will find a piece of dough in the oven. And then we know that dough has yeast. We know that if the dough has enough yeast in it and enough whatever flour, under the temperature conditions of the oven, we can map out, we can calculate how it will become a piece of bread. I'll say, well, that's really great. But where does the dough come from? You're simply saying that we can There's a probability you might find it in some oven. Great, that's true. There's a probability. There's at least one oven right now that's baking bread in Liverpool. That's true. But it doesn't explain where the dough comes from. But if you're too much focusing about the mechanism of how dough becomes bread and non-zero probabilities, you forget that they've just told you that something comes from nothing by nothing. You understand? So that's why the assumptions are so sophisticated, they hide the contradiction. See, and that's all we do as du'at, as callers to Islam, is we just disentangle it and explain and show it to people, there's the contradiction in this, it's quite obvious. Yeah, we demystify the sometimes pseudo-scientific arguments and wordings. So assumptions are the only things that can block a rational mind from coming to a conclusion that God exists. So as I said, as the assumptions become more sophisticated, more contrived and absurd, in order to hide the internal contradiction, the arguments to refute these contradictions must also be sophisticated too. Because now you have to painstakingly almost drag the atheist through every tiny little assumption they've made and refute every tiny assumption to clear the path, you know, clear the road of the debris, so there's a straight, clear path to belief in God. That's what we have to do. That's what we do with people who are stricken with a lot of these sophisticated assumptions. As a wise friend of mine once said about people who are lost in sophisticated assumptions, the hardest thing to explain to people is the bloody obvious, right? Because if they've been lost in so many assumptions, then the hardest thing to explain to them is the obvious. It becomes really hard, even though it's meant to be so obvious. Wish I could claim credit for that, but it's a friend of mine that came up with it, so. All right, so what kind of assumptions do we see? These are not exhaustive list. There's all kinds of assumptions, but these are generally the kind of categories you get. So the first assumption is positivism, that only knowledge gained from the senses is factual. So only knowledge gained from the senses is factual. So they would argue that sometimes, although some would believe that logical proofs are acceptable to them, but they say that actually it's not 100% certain. The law of non-contradiction, how do you know that's always that certain? How do you know the law of non-contradiction always is the case? So they might say, hey, science might show us that something can come from nothing. We haven't seen nothing. If we saw nothing, we could then examine it like nothing is a thing, even though it literally means nothing. Right? So they say nothing, say if you treat it as a thing, then it becomes another object, and then science is about looking at objects. And science says you can't talk about an object until you've experimented on it, you've observed it. So if we just kind of a bait and switch, if I just make you think that nothing is a thing, then you can talk about it like a scientific object. Yeah, well, it's not a thing, is it? Yeah. But they'll say, hey, if we saw nothing, maybe we could, and we experiment on it, maybe we could see nothing does produce something. Say, no, because by definition it's nothing. It's no thing at all. It's not a thing. They say science might show us that contradictions are possible. Why? Because they say, well, you know, just because you haven't seen it yet, yeah, doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Yeah, they say that. I say, well, no, but by definition, contradictions are impossible because contradiction is literally, well, if you think about what it negates itself. It says itself doesn't exist. If you actually think about what contradiction means, I know in Latin contradiction means saying a word against itself, but if something exists and then it doesn't exist at the same time, it negates itself. It says it doesn't exist. Right, so that's what contradiction, there's no, the assumption behind this, they say, is that, you know, human laws are fabricated by human beings and they could be wrong. The law of non-contradiction is a human law, and therefore it made by humans, therefore it might not be true. And they say, no, the law of non-contradiction is a logical law that we use for logic, yes, and generally rational thinking, yes, but it's not a law of the universe, it's just reality, right? And what I mean by that is that law of non-contradiction simply states that something can't negate its existence at the same time. Simple as that. Because if it does, it doesn't exist. So quite literally, contradiction doesn't exist by definition, because what it means is that something negates itself, its existence. That's what it means. If I say, this exists, actually doesn't, well, then it doesn't exist. Right? So it's not a human law, it's just quite literally reality. I don't know how to, it's the most foundational thing possible to say. Infinite regress might be possible outside of time. Sequential change going back an eternity past. That might be possible, but because maybe it's only a problem in time, but outside of time, you can have an infinite regress. And I say, well, no, because time just means what? It means change. You can't have an infinite amount of changes finishing, because infinity means non-finishing, and hence contradiction. Right? So quite simple. Sometimes they might say, well, in mathematics, we can have infinite sets. So they want to do mathematics here, or have encountered Cantor's infinite sets, right? You heard about it. They say, well, you can have an infinite set. Well, firstly, you can't, physically speaking. But even if we imagine there's an infinite amount of things, yeah, you can imagine that. But that's not what infinite regress is. Again, the assumption, that in a way, they're almost lying to you, but they don't realize it. Infinite regress isn't an infinite set of stuff. Infinite regress is a bunch of things that are linked to each other and depend on each other going back into the past or going back in a chain of dependencies. They're not just a collection of, like, oh, I've got a bag of infinite bags in this bag. It's not just a collection of stuff. It's stuff where one of those members depends on all the members behind it to finish completing itself, to get to it. Any one of those members. It's a different thing altogether. But if they sell you the wrong understanding of what an infinite regress is, you won't see the problem of infinite regress. Epistemological nihilism, how can you know anything for sure? Maybe you're in the Matrix, if you know that film. I'm showing my age now. I can't even believe now that saying the word Matrix now shows my age. But what's the Matrix? A person once told me in my previous lectures, say, oh my God, okay. A fictional simulation, computer simulation. How do you know you're not inside a computer simulation? You're not a brain in a vat with like electrodes connected to you giving you a false reality. You're not dreaming right now or you're in a coma and you're imagining all this. So how do you know that's not the case? So if you, because you don't know, they'll say, then you know you can't know anything for certain. And I say, well, actually, I can, yeah? But, and again, you have to drag them through, okay, well, let's start from the first principles. I'm sensing something, well, actually, I'll get to the refutation in a bit, but I'm just gonna tell you what they say. So they say that, how do you know that nothing exists? So if you can't be certain, so here's the thing, if you can't be certain that what you're seeing is accurate or correct, then you can't be certain about anything. And I say, there's a difference between not being certain about the particulars of what I'm seeing and nothing existing. Because I'm seeing something, I'm observing something, I'm experiencing something. So clearly, nothing can't exist in this case. Yeah, but they jump from one assumption to the next and you don't realize. So they say that, I don't know God exists for certain because I can't even know that anything exists for certain. You know? So then they'll tell you there's no possible evidence you could ever prove to them that God definitely exists because evidence itself doesn't exist for certain. You understand? They start closing all those doors to clear rational thinking. You have to open those doors one by one. They'll say, maybe time might be an illusion. So maybe the universe is eternal, but time is an illusion. They now argue that using a kind of block time or a type of fourth dimensional time that they say is in a block universe. They actually argue this today, although the ancient Greeks, some of the Eleatic school of ancient Greece argue the same thing. We're going to get to refute these bit by bit, but I'm just going to show all the assumptions. Or physicalism or naturalism, all that exists is only physical. So they'll say, hey, if you know, all that exists is only physical, the problem with this is that they're not being objective about the physical world. You need evidence from the physical world that the physical world is all that exists. You know, tangible things that your senses can detect, the physical world. But they come in with the assumption that, no, only the physical world. Why? Because I can only see the physical world. Well, that's an assumption. Or they say that observations of the physical world just are. Let's not talk about causes. They just are, right? And they use another assumption. They say, hey, if God can just be, why can't we say the universe just is? It's an assumption because God and the universe are not the same thing. And it's not special pleading. Let's say you're doing special pleading. No. It's because they're fundamentally of different natures, quote unquote, which we'll come to. The universe is dependent, and I'll show you why it's dependent, and God is not dependent. So clearly then they're not in the same category to be equivalent. They might say unexplained phenomena is random. You ever heard of God of the Gaps, where they say if you have a gap in your knowledge, you put God there. And I say, well, you put randomness there, where there's a gap in human knowledge. You say things are random. And we'll come to a situation where they thought something was random, then it turned out not to be random. So they get refuted themselves, but then they always claim, no, but theists are always refuted by science. Well, no, actually, you guys are refuted by science quite a bit. The unexplained constants of the universe, like, for example, the constant of gravity or quantum constants that we see, they'll say these are just arbitrary. They just are what they are. There's no one determined what they are. They just are. These are all assumptions which are not borne out by reality. But if you make these assumptions, they'll say we don't need God anymore because they just are. Then the other one I call false theism predictions. They say if God exists, I don't believe in God. Why? Because if God exists, then surely we'd see, right? They say we'd see evidence from science, from the physical world. But if we see anything physical, that can't be God, if we go into what definition of what God is. So, but they might know this already, or they set it up like that, but they set it up to fail. And some Muslim were telling me in a debate with an atheist, they were saying, ask this atheist guy, ask him what evidence would be acceptable to him to prove God's existence. But there is no evidence that they'd be acceptable to him. And some Muslims think it's a good argument, but the atheist, I didn't use it in my debate with my recent atheist called Matt Dillahunty. I didn't use the argument against him, I was challenging him, what evidence would be acceptable to you, because he'd simply respond, it doesn't matter that there is no evidence acceptable to me, because if God exists, then surely he would make it available evidence that would be acceptable to me. Right? So it's not my fault that he made his universe in a way that makes it impossible for him to prove himself to me. That's how he responds. He'll say, yeah, just because I don't have any evidence I think is acceptable to me doesn't mean that I'm wrong. It means that God is unable to make a universe that makes evidence, which is physical or what have you, that would be acceptable to me for his from his nihilism or nihilist perspective, and so on. Other things, if God exists, then surely you'd get a Nobel Prize for the discovery, right? Ridiculous. Well, so you're saying that a bunch of guys will have an ijma to give a consensus to give you a Nobel Prize for saying something. Well, that's just, isn't it? You're relying on human beings to decide what is true and false. Then you might as well just believe in a priesthood or something. And, you know, I can get you a bunch of scholars that will say, Islamic scholars that will say that, you know, that God exists and what have you. So you can accept that? No. So then why should I accept? No, Nobel Prizes are for new knowledge. I jokingly argue they're for new knowledge, not for stuff you already know. We already know anyway. Yeah. It's like saying that I discovered the sun exists. You're not going to get a Nobel Prize for that, even though it's true. The sun exists. Or if God exists, maybe you'll expect his signature in the universe. Why did you expect that? Yeah. Or they'll say, maybe you'll see an image of him. If he exists, then surely we'd see an image of, or we'd see him himself wearing a white robe and a beard. Yeah. Again, who said that that must be the case if he exists? They assume it, and then they point to the fact that you can't see that, and then they use it to say, look, see, my argument has been made for me. We can't see this prediction that I've predicted that it would be the case if God existed, therefore God doesn't exist. No, your predictions are false. They're based on assumptions. And they also say, if God exists, then surely it would be easy to know he exists and not require long arguments, right? But they've only made us need to bring long arguments because they brought long assumptions, right? So that's the problem. Defeating atheist assumptions, quite simply, sequentially, science is the study of the motion of things relative to each other, not what things ultimately are, being, right? So whether you're doing chemistry, pharmacy, biology, or physics, ultimately it's all about the study of things and how they move relative to each other. Energy moves, mass and matter moves. That's really what you're studying in science, how it moves. But not ultimately, if you can't divide it any further, what it is, you don't know. Science has the inability to tell you what the most fundamental things are made out of if they can't be divided further. It can only tell you what an atom is, by telling you the smaller components of what it's made out of, a nucleus with a proton and neutron, and with electrons that go in an electron cloud around it. It tells you what something is by the things inside it and how they move. But if you can't divide it any further, they can't tell you what it is anymore. Science is limited. It's only about motion of things, but not what the things truly ultimately what they are. And we're going to go into how that shows that God exists. So again, when atheists will talk about science, they don't sometimes some of them accept mathematics and logic. Others would say we don't know for certain mathematics and logic is true, and they'll say that even though despite the fact that science depends on maths and logic to express itself and to be correct and true. Also, science discovers many things by hypothesizing unseen causes behind stuff and then making predictions about what should be the case if they're true and then seeing if those predictions match. So here was the case. They saw these pollen grains in water, and the pollen grains were just moving in very random motions. They called it Brownian motion, the study of random motion, things moving randomly, right? And they just say it's random. It's just random. What was happening, of course? Does anyone know? Anyone here study physics or chemistry? Brownian motion and these random movement of pollen grains in water. Could anyone tell me what was happening? Why were they moving randomly? No? You don't study this stuff? All right. It was the water molecules hitting them. The water molecules, which can be calculated, if you knew where their positions were and how they were moving, you could calculate exactly what each pollen grain would do. But because you can't see them, they couldn't see the water molecules, they assumed that these pollen grains were moving by themselves randomly. Yeah, randomness of the gaps. But now we know. Now we know that it's not random. It's just so complex. In fact, randomness, in the sense that the atheists now, some atheists say it in a metaphysical sense, doesn't actually exist. Randomness is a human word for complexity outside of our knowledge. That's all it is. Right? Rolling a dice is random. No, if you knew the strength of gravity, the air pressure, and all these different variables, each atom, each air molecule, where it was, and how much energy you threw the dice on and what side it was facing up on your hand. If you could know all these variables, you could calculate 100% exactly what the dice roll would be. But if you don't, because it's so complex, it appears to you to be quote unquote random. But random is just complexity outside of your knowledge. That's all it is. Nihilism. Easy to refute epistemological nihilism, as in how do we know anything exists? Simply, all finite effects must have a cause. We can demonstrate that. But even if we don't accept that, very simply, we're experiencing something, so the experiencer exists. You exist. You know that for certain because you're experiencing something. Even if you're a brain in the vat in the matrix or what have you, you're still, you yourself exist. You are aware. You're self-aware anyway, or at least you're aware. Even if you're not self-aware, you're aware. So you can't be aware if you don't exist, basically. You're observing something outside yourself, so there's an external world to you. Forget about whether it's a matrix or a computer program or aliens manipulating your brain in the back. There's an external world to you, you know that for certain. And you can't control it. Yeah? 100% of the time. Anyway, you can't control it. So the external world, you are not the god of this external world. In fact, there are even times when you feel things that you don't like pain. Pain is a reminder that you're not the god of the universe, because you can't avert things you don't like. Some people might think if they only got things they liked, that somehow they were god in a way, because they'll say, I'm willing only good things for myself. But if you get pain and suffering, that just reminds you that you're not the god of this universe. Yeah. You're observing change. So whether you're in the matrix or not, things are changing. So change exists for definite. Right? You're absolutely certain that change exists, and you're observing different images in one view, meaning, for example, you're seeing white and you're seeing black and you're seeing this, is it purple? You're seeing these different sensations at the same time. What that means is that reality is not indivisible, but divisible into these different things, and therefore reality has space, or you could say extension, as we call it, space or extension. Because you can only have different things if there's space for it, right? So you know that space exists or extension exists, and you know that change exists. You know there's an external world outside yourself. You know that you don't control that external world, and you know that you exist. There's so many things you can tell for absolute certain. And guess what, everybody? This is enough to be able to prove God's existence, right? Which we'll come to. Fake fears and predictions are based on the atheist assumption about what a God is or does, and that should be corrected with minimal predictions. Meaning, what is the bare minimum we would expect if the universe or everything that exists has a God? Well, you can look at it from the opposite. What if the universe, there was no God behind the universe, what would you expect to see? If there was no creator, the universe would consist of things which are independent, so because they're not dependent, they're independent. And therefore, if they're independent, then they would not change, they would not move, and they could not be moved. Because everything, is, if it's independent, nothing could change it, nothing could affect it. But if you live in a universe of things that can be affected, and you yourself are affecting these things and are affected by it, then that indicates there's something else that is independent and not this universe. Right? Very simple way of looking at it. And of course, if there was more than one God, because we might imagine there's only one God, well, here's the first Quranic, the second Quranic argument against that, which you know very well. If there was more than one God, the universe would be disordered. And they might say, but isn't there chaos in the universe? No, the laws of physics would be changing every single second, or smaller than that. The laws of physics would be changing, as there would be conflict of multiple wills behind the universe. This is the Quranic argument refuting the false assumption, right? All finite things go back to a determiner. Here's a very simple argument for this. There's simple ways of saying it, and there's a bit more technical ways of saying the same thing. But here you go. A finite thing has a size. So anything like this chair has a size. Did it determine its own size? Well, no, because if it did, it would have to create itself. And of course, something can't make itself. It has to exist first to make itself, and of course, then it wouldn't need to be made by itself. So that's absurd. So it didn't determine its own size, but if a finite thing exists at a size it didn't determine, then it was determined by something else. So this chair didn't determine its size because it didn't make itself, then its size was determined by something else. Therefore, all finite things are created by something else. Very simple argument. But of course, the average atheist or skeptic might not like the argument. They think it's too simple, and they start nitpicking at it, and then you have to make it a bit more sophisticated. You have to drag them. And so then it becomes this, right? Where you have to drag them tooth and nail. A finite thing is a thing that exists by way of its extension, i.e. it depends on its extension to exist. If this chair had no size, it wouldn't be a chair, it wouldn't exist. Right, as a chair, anyway. Right, so then here's the possibilities. Finite things either determine themselves into existence, i.e. they made themselves, we know that's a contradiction. So then the only two left is they either are determining themselves, so then the chair is determining its size right now, or it was determined by something else. So these are now the two possibilities. Let's look at the first one. If they're determining themselves to a particular finite extent, why do they have a size that stops that? So why is this chair not twice the size it is, or half the size it is? Why is it that particular size? What's determining it to be that size and not a different size? So if they are extending themselves to that length, they can also extend themselves shorter or longer. So if this chair is sustaining itself to that size, it can make itself smaller or bigger because it is the sustainer of itself, right? But if it can make itself bigger or smaller, then it is not limited to any size to exist. So, you know, and if it can make itself bigger, then where does this exercise come from? You know, from nothing. So if it can make itself bigger, and then it can add new stuff to itself, or make itself smaller. But then if that's the case, then it's not limited to existing at any particular extension, and it is separate from extension. I.e., if this chair can determine its size, then it exists separate from size. It transcends size, transcends shape. And if so, then not limited. In essence, the thing behind the chair is the thing that is independent. But the thing behind the chair isn't the chair. whatever is sustaining this chair isn't the chair itself, because the chair is defined by shape. So there's something behind the shape of the chair that's making giving the chair that shape. Therefore, all finite things were determined by something else. Ultimately, this thing must not be finite. So it can't be created or bounded by something else. So it's very simple. Now, I said the same thing I said in the previous argument. I just made it a bit more sophisticated, because you have to drag the skeptic bit by bit by bit over every tiny detail to get rid of their assumptions and so on and so forth. So we know that this chair was defined by, or is just being sustained by something else, and was created by something, or defined by something else. Okay, we can know that because it's finite, it's limited. Of course, intuitively, your fitra already knows this stuff. Whenever you see any shape, even a rock, a mountain, the sun, you always ask, what shaped it that way? What made it that way? Because you know it could have been bigger, could have been smaller, so what made it that size? You know it automatically, but when your intuition, the unconscious process in your brain already works this out. All I've really done is given words to it, right? But when you have someone who's struck by assumptions, you have to persuade them with words. You have to then spell it, and they're really sophisticated in assumptions. You have to spell it out, each tiny part to them. And lastly, they'll say, how do we know that physicalism, or like a universe of only physical things, is not sufficient to explain itself? Why does it need a god or a creator? So it's very simple. You can demonstrate it in the following argument, right? Very following argument to show that the universe is insufficient to exist by itself. Many people have said, you might have heard the argument from contingency. I don't know if you've heard of this, right? The argument from contingency is they say the universe is made out of contingent things, and they depend on something that is independent or necessary existence. You've heard this thing. And what the atheists will respond is, they'll say, how do you know everything is contingent? Yeah? Like, it depends on something else. How do you know that? How do you know that everything in this universe depends on something else? You know, you said, well, I can move it and I can change it. And they're like, oh, but maybe you can might move it or change it, but maybe fundamentally it's made out of fundamental particles like quarks and leptons and all kinds of other things, which are fundamental. And they always exist. They're eternal. They're necessary. Why not that? That's the case. Now, what they've done is, again, they've confused you with assumptions using other words, making you think that science has shown there these things are not contingent or dependent things, and then you get confused. So then we have to basically drag them over bit by bit details to show them why what they're saying is wrong. So I simply developed this argument to show that everything that has extensional space is dependent, right? And so there must be something outside of space and time that isn't dependent, but creates space and time. So they say, give me your evidence for God. Where's your evidence for God? So here you go, space and time, right? Now you notice there I put the Earth, which is rotating on its own axis, facing the sun. Because one of the ways you know about time is you know from night and day. Right, regular rotation, regular motion that returns back to its original configuration is a definition of time that we can come up with, scientists can come up with. The only measure of time is something that is circular, that returns back to its original settings on a uniform or regular way, is definition of time, or change, or movement, or how to measure time anyway. So, time and space, that's my evidence for God, right? But how is the evidence for God? Well, let's start with, let's define what we mean by God, because sometimes the atheists will say, you put God here, there, whatever, but you don't even know how to define God. You just say God is a great maximal being, or a being that has perfection. These are words that the atheists will say are vague. They're vague words. Perfection, maximal being, what does that mean? Okay, well, I'll give you very clear definitions. And one of the reasons why, when I talk about these arguments, I try my very best not to use philosophical terms. I try to make it most plainly English possible, is because I don't want to make people think that they have to study philosophy to know this stuff. I think anyone can understand this. That's why I deliberately, in my debates and my lectures, I try to use as much plain English as possible. That's why. Minimal definition, God is necessary, i.e. he must have always existed. He must exist. There's no point in the past he didn't exist, quote unquote. So he has to exist. Or he's the first existence. There's nothing before him, basically. That's all it is. Independent. So not doesn't depend on anything else. Pretty straightforward. Has the power to create or exert power. Power in physics is work done, but basically can do things. Things can happen with the exertion of power. He can make things or create things from nothing. He can choose to do that. So he can choose not to, can choose to do it. And if he can choose to do it, has intention and will, intends what he creates, or will. I suppose, although you could argue that will is circular, because will just means the capacity to choose, I suppose. So it might be circular, but I added there because intention and will simply conveys to you very clearly that this is what they call an agent, right? Something that is not just a mindless thing, but has agency, or i.e. it can choose, in essence, right? It chooses, and ultimately you can even work out that he has knowledge as well, because if he intends to do something, he must have knowledge about what he's doing. Anyway, so that's my definition, very minimal definition, and that's what we mean by God, as the most minimal definition. So let's see if we encounter this definition anywhere in our investigations. Now, I'm going to just tell you guys, I put some diagrams up. Now, don't worry about the technical side of this discussion. It's quite simple to understand, but I'm going to give you the technical side of this argument, just so you're able to deal with anyone that you come up with. I used this against an atheist called Matt Dillahunty, who was very good at ripping down arguments made by Christian theists and so on and so forth, by pointing out this premise here is wrong, or this premise here is assumed, or this premise is vague. He will minutely investigate people's premises and their arguments to destroy it. So this one had to be really, how should I put this, rigorous, all right? But it's actually quite simple, okay? So, first and foremost, we have observable reality. Forget using the word universe. What do we mean by universe? How big universe? Forget that. You have observable reality. Because stuff you're observing. Simple definition, okay? What's it caused by, if anything? Well, first possibility is it's observable reality made itself, which we say is a contradiction. Observable reality is uncaused, which I'm about to argue is a contradiction. Or God, or the other alternatives are observable reality was caused by nothing, so it was created by nothing. Or the other possibility is observable reality was caused by something with no intention or will. Okay, like multiverse. Let's just say as one example, yeah? So these are the only possibilities that are there. These are the only possibilities. There's no other possibility you can imagine outside of that. So let's go over these and see if they are, if they actually do indeed possess contradictions. As I said in my debate, very simple principle, the law of non-contradiction. If we encounter a contradiction, we are going to negate it. So if something has a contradiction, we know it's not true. And we're going to simply use the principle of P or not P. So either something is, for example, independent or not independent, or if something is necessary or not necessary. These are the kind of things that we're going to go into. But it's not that difficult. Now, this is the simple version of the argument I'm about to present. So inference from space or extension. This is a simple version. It's very simple to follow. There is existence. Not really complicated. Existence can be of two kinds, dependent or independent, right? It can either be existence that depends on something else, or existence that doesn't depend on anything else, right? There's no other, is there a third possibility? Do you think any third possibilities? No. Okay, so simple, reality cannot consist of only dependent existences. So I use a simple example. I say, imagine you're a penniless student, maybe some of you don't need to imagine that, and you want to go buy a sandwich from a local shop, and you need some money for that, and so you ask your friend, can I lend some money from you? He doesn't have any money either. He asks his friend, can I lend some money from you? He doesn't have any money either, because he's poor, and so on, so on, so forth. If you asked an infinite number of students who were all poor and had no money, would you ever get money to buy that sandwich? No. So you can't have a reality of only dependent existences, because at some point you have to have something that it is based upon. that is not independent, is not dependent, but is independent, doesn't need anything else, lend you the money, has some money to lend, basically. And the analogy of being able to buy sandwiches, being able to exist, and that's what the analogy is. So there has to be, there must be independent existence somewhere. Maybe it's this universe is independent, maybe whatever. I'm not saying it's anywhere in particular, I'm just saying it has to be somewhere. There's something that exists that is independent, doesn't need anything else to exist, okay? You can't have an infinite regress of dependent things. That's another way of putting it. So anything that depends on space to exist is dependent. Like this chair, right? If this chair depends on space to exist, if it didn't have the space, it wouldn't exist. Okay? So therefore, the independent existence does not depend on extension or space to exist. What that means is that wherever is independent out there that doesn't depend on anything, doesn't depend on space to have a place to exist. Simple. And if it doesn't depend on space to exist, and it is independent, well, if something doesn't depend on space to exist, then it is indivisible, because if space can be divided, right? Whereas in something that's independent, obviously, doesn't depend on space, and so exists outside of space, and so can't be divided, is indivisible. And if it's indivisible, then there can only be one independent existence, because you can't divide it into more than one. And if so, then there can only be one. And therefore, and of course, if the independent existence creates dependent existence, there's nothing smaller than it, the independent existence is not made of anything smaller than itself. If it was, it would be dependent. So it's not made of anything smaller, and yet it still creates things that exist in space, doesn't have to, then it can only be explained by choice. It does so because it wants to. There's no mechanisms inside it. There's no gears or mechanisms that's making it make things, right? That's the simple argument. Very simple. That's all it is. But of course, you can get nitpicking skeptics or atheists, and so you have to say, okay, well, with diagrams, right? Then I say, simple, the same thing. You can't have relatively independent existences. There must be an independent existence. That's pretty straightforward, as I already mentioned. But then you say, anything that is composed of parts depends on those parts to exist. Because they'll say, how do you know things are dependent? And there where you have to drag them, say, oh, let me show you, the castle depends on the sand to exist, right? If there's no sand, then there's no castle. So in reality, in a way, the castle doesn't actually exist, just the sand, because the forms don't really exist, only the material that's made up of, that's arranged in those forms. But forms don't really exist, in a way, right? So then, if that's the case, anything extended in space, likewise, depends on a composite of spatial divisions to exist. Anything that has size can be divided up. It's made of its internal divisions. You can always imagine it could be divided up in many ways. Even if you can't physically divide it up, it can be. It is made up of whatever is inside the area, whatever is inside there. Because remember, the square doesn't exist. Only the shape of the thing it's made out of. Right. So the square depends on whatever it's made out of to exist. Right. Now guess what? Anything that is extended in space is always divisible, and is always dependent, because you can imagine going smaller and smaller. No matter how small you go, it always has size. Right. And so what you get to, and what I actually argued against this atheist called Matt Delahunty, is that the problem with him, I said, with his worldview, is that you can't have a universe of only forms, but no substance. Because if anything exists and it depends on an area, it's just a shape. It's just a form. Where's the substance? I said jokingly, the problem with your worldview is it lacks substance. That was a little bit of a dig I had. I mean, funny one, it's just a good-natured one. So therefore, the independent existence somewhere out there cannot be divisible and doesn't depend on extension in space to exist. What is in the independent existence? It is something, it doesn't depend on form. It is something that creates forms. But the extended existence can't be produced In the universe, what we call the extended existence, or has shape or size, it can't be made out of a composite of adding together independent existences of no extension. So what they might say is, they'll say, how do you know that the universe is made up of tiny points of no extension that make up, which are independent, they don't depend on anything else, but they make up the universe. The substance of the universe is not a bunch of independent things which are tiny, so tiny they actually have no space. So here's the problem with that. If I add together a bunch of bricks that have no size, how much, someone's going crazy out there or something, says weird noises. Is that the sound of your brains trying to work this out? No, it's actually quite easy. Basically, they might say, okay, I concede that anything that has a shape or size is dependent, great. But how do you know that the things you're seeing in the universe are not built out of building blocks of zero size? Okay? So then you say, okay, well, let's add them together, shall we? Let's add an infinite amount of things that have no size. How much, what size comes out of it? Zero. It doesn't matter how many things of zero size you add, they always come out to be zero. So what does that mean then? That means that extended existence can't be made out of independent existence, things that are independent that have no size. So then there's a separation then. They're not the same thing. They can't be made out of the other. So the only thing that explains it is that extended existence, whatever it is dependent on independent existence to extend it into existence, i.e. create it. Right? So the independent existence is not the substance of the universe, but it is the one that creates the universe, extends it into existence, creates extension itself. Right? By power. So in other words, let's just say, God doesn't make the universe out of himself, right? But rather he makes the universe from exerting power. Right? Extending it, adding to reality by adding from nothing. So then, if the independent existence is indivisible, it cannot be separated or divided into multiples, and therefore there is only one independent existence. So independent existence, even if you had 1,000 independent existences, there couldn't be 1,000 because they'd all be the one and the same thing. Let's just put it this way, there's not enough space for more than one God because there's no space, quite literally. Okay, now, I want to give a little caveat here for those people who know about Islamic doctrines and different schools of thought in Islam. There's ikhtilaf amongst Muslims for centuries and centuries between the Ash'ari, between the Athari schools and Maturidi and so on and so forth. So I simply put that, I argue that God doesn't depend on face, right? But some people believe that he has shape. But everyone accepts that he doesn't depend on anything. So he doesn't depend on space. The Ash'ari would say no form. He's not of any form, and some people say he has a form, but we say bila kayf without expressing how. But the point is that God doesn't depend on space. That's all we have to argue, right? And guess what? Ibn Taymiyyah, who's from the the Athari school, has the same argument. He would be believing that God has some kind of a form, but we say bila kayf. We don't say how, without what it is or what have you. Yeah, but everyone agrees that God doesn't depend on space. Everyone agrees on that. So this argument you can use by any school of thought you want. Anyway, so if there's only one independent existence and all of observable reality is dependent, then guess what? All extended things in reality depend on one independent existence to exist. Done. That's it. That's the argument from space. And guess what? Even if you're a brain in the vat, or you're imagining things, or you're in a coma, what have you, a'udhu billah, you could still come to the exact same conclusion. Because all you need to do is to see that space. You observe space, whatever it is. Even in a program, there's space. In a computer program, there's space. Right. Okay. And if independent existence is indivisible, then there is nothing more fundamental than it. And if there's nothing more fundamental than it, it produces extended existence without compulsion from another more fundamental source. As in, it has no components. There's no components inside it. Yeah? So if it creates, then it does so because it chooses to do. There's no other explanation. Right? And if that's the case, so, and if intention is defined as an unnecessary choice, not compelled by prior or more fundamental causes, and if it is uncaused, independent existence, and it creates with intention, this meets the definition of God. So if God is not forced to create, and nothing, he doesn't depend on anything, of course, and nothing compels him to do it, and he does so, then he chooses to do so, he has intention. And his intention, this meets the minimal definition of God that we defined at the very beginning. Okay. Some atheists complained, oh, you're defining God into existence. Said, no, I came up with a definition, here's the concept we believe in. Now let's see if we can find that concept in our investigation of reality. That's all I did. I didn't define him into existence. Yeah. So that's it. That's all the argument you need to make. The next argument, don't worry, there's only two, space and time. So do we have enough space and time for this final one? Okay, inshallah. All right, so we'll wrap up pretty soon. So there is existence, yep, kel surprise. Something cannot come from nothing by nothing, so there must have always been existence. There must have always been existence, because existence couldn't have started from nothing by nothing, so there must have been something that always was existing. Okay, I think everyone can agree on that. No one disputes that because it produces a contradiction. So here you go. There cannot be an infinite regress of change, because change is about one thing happening after the other and depending on the previous condition. So there must have been a first thing. You can't have an infinite regress of change. As we said, if this lecture went on forever, it wouldn't stop, right? Yeah, by definition. And again, if you had to wait for forever for this lecture to begin, then again, it wouldn't begin. So the fact that we've arrived at today, we can know for certain that there was an infinite past or infinite regress of change. There must have been a first thing. Guess what? Either the first thing was static or not static. Yeah? Either the first thing is static or it's not static. So if the first thing is, so if non-static, so if it's moving, if it's being moved, an infinite regress, because the thing that created the universe itself has always been moving, then it's always changing, and itself has an infinite change going back into the past. So all you've said is, instead of the universe being infinite in the past, you're saying something else is infinite in the past. Yeah, and that would be the same problem, right? Infinite regress. So but if you say it's completely static, it's just static, right? It's a static, it's mindless, has no will, no intention, just completely static, then why does it move? Or why does it initiate things? If something is completely static, no change would occur. There's only way to break the deadlock is it must have created the change or beginning change by choice. Something that begins movement, let's just say, begins to create things that move or change is the only possibility. And of course, if it's the first thing, if there's nothing before it, if it's the first cause or the first thing that exists, there's nothing behind it that pushes it to do stuff, right? So it starts things from itself, then it has will, it has choice, it initiates it. Nothing is making it do it. There's no before circumstances that made God do what he did. Right? He just initiates things. That's a simple argument, very simple. Right? Of course, here's the more complicated version, slightly complicated version, but not much. So same thing. There's existence, something can't come from nothing by nothing. There must have always been something existing, a first or necessary existence. Time is change, as you know, ascertained by experience, things are changing. Change is either defined as an arrangement or form or extension of things that depend on something prior to it, so arrangements always rearranging themselves. Or change could be also that something didn't exist and then an arrangement came into existence. So this chair comes into, this chair is an arrangement of wood, complex wood starches. It's an arrangement, okay? So either this chair was rearranged from prior things, like wood that was rearranged into this chair, or this chair popped into existence de novo from nothing, okay? That's what it is. So change can either be of these two types. There can't be an infinite regress of arrangements and things and changes, basically the same thing I said before. And so we have to look at then, okay, so there must be a first existence. So what can the first existence be? Either the first existence is an arrangement, form, or extension itself. It's just basically a thing that has shape. Or something that does not depend on shape or form, right? Okay, well, arrangement or shape depends on its constituent members to move, because it's not the chair that is moving, but everything inside the chair that is moving that makes it move. So every particular wood starch molecule and then quark and what have you, those are things that are moving, because the chair is just a shape, it's a form of something. It's the something that's moving, not the shape itself. That's what I'm saying there. Okay? So things that are shapes don't move by themselves, but the things that they're made out of are the ones that do the moving. The first existence can't depend on a shape, basically, because it is the first existence. It can't depend on shape, as we said before. Where did change come from? What was the first change? Then the first change must be that the first existence creates the first shape. Right? Creates the first shape, and then after that, the second thing that happens after that is that the shape moves and rearranges itself. Right? That's it. So the first thing that changed wasn't the first cause, but was rather the first thing that the first cause did was it made something and then changes that something over time, as in with every moment of change. So the first existence creates and acts and creates the first moment of time, the first arrangement, and then afterwards that arrangement just keeps rearranging it. The first existence being the first cause therefore precludes any prior external or internal causes to it. So nothing was prior to it, so it has no mechanisms or nothing is pushing to do it. So if it makes something, then it does so because it has choice and it chooses to do so, and we end up in the same conclusion. Okay? So it meets the definition of God, something that is not that makes things and it's not necessary to make things. So what I've done simply is I've simply shown that all the possibilities, right? So all those things we've seen produce contradictions when you think about them and you examine them. The only thing left is God as the only concept that is left. And of course, we see that in time, the universe is being, the observable reality is being created, and in space, from the space axis, it's being sustained. So the universe, God didn't make the universe and then walked away, but he's actively sustaining it, because everything in his universe is just forms of his power, or ayat, right, of his power. So space and time are the best evidence for God. Why? Because we know they must exist, space and time. Whether you're in the Matrix or whether you're in a coma or what have you, you know that there's space and time. There has to be, because you're seeing it, you're observing it, you're experiencing it. And if they exist, then God has to exist, because he's the only possible explanation left after you remove all contradictions. You could say the only thing you can know for certain after you exist is that God exists. Right? And not many other things in life you know for certain. And guess what? Is it my argument? In the Quran, surely in the creation of the heavens and the earth, space and extension, and in the alternation of day and night, change in time, if you like, these are signs for people of reason. And then, of course, the Quran says, with power did we construct the heaven, verily we are able to extend the vastness of space thereof. There are other verses. Interesting, it starts with space and then it begins the creation of arrangement, and then the arrangement gets changed. So space, then time. And of course, and then it has time, but then time precedes all that Allah has created in the heavens and the earth. So this verse says, look, the creation of the heavens and the earth, but time goes before all the things that developed inside the heavens and the earth. So time develops all the things. You need time to develop all the things inside the heavens and the earth. Very interesting how the Quran places these words, the wording of these verses. But what we also see is that the Quran says space was initially was created initially as one unit and then expanded into the current universe. So we know this verse. Have not those who disbelieved known that the heavens and the earth were joined together as one piece and then we parted them? But also here we see in this verse that the universe was expanded, so Allah raised its ceiling and then proportioned it. Yeah. So what we're seeing is that these are here in the Quran, these are the arguments that the Quran uses, space and time, as one of the fundamental reasons for God's existence that you can know for certain. And of course that he is the sustainer of all things as well. So he's actively sustaining it. Again, his throne extends over the heavens and the earth. And their preservation does not tire him at all whatsoever. So There we have it. I think we'll leave it there. But the argument from space and time isn't one I just concocted out of modern science, but it's actually in the Quran itself. I've simply explained it simply and more sophisticatedly in other versions, simply to deal with the assumptions made by those who are the deniers. So barakallahu feekum for your patience and for listening, and inshallah this will be up online for you to watch. So barakallahu feekum.